ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, and for the next hour, you're in Finland. And today is July 21st, 2008, and you know, of all the days of the year, July 21st has more important events on it than almost any other day, that is, dates in history. And I say that because there's at least two major things that happened on this day, and it's unusual to have two major anniversaries on the same day. The first was 1969. So, audience, do you remember what happened on July 21st, 1969? It caused Walter Cronkite to take off his glasses and almost weep in awe. It was the day that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon. It was Apollo 11, and men walked on the moon, something that would have been, that was almost unthinkable 10 years earlier. And of course, JFK gets credit for that, even though he didn't do most of the work. The second thing that happened was July 21st was really the first major battle of the Civil War. Now, I know we say it began when the South fired on Fort Sumter in South Carolina, and that's all true, but this was the day that the Battle of Bull Run began, okay? Or Manassas, as the South called it. I think the North calls it Bull Run and the South called it Manassas. Of course, the Confederacy named the battles differently than the North, so you have to keep those things straight. But Manassas is only about 15 miles from where I live. I've been out to the Manassas battlefield, and it was July 21st, 1861, and people thought that the war might be entertaining, and so people came out in their carriages and sat up on a ridge to watch the battle. And that was the only time in the war I think that probably happened, because they were horrified by how bloody war was. It hadn't occurred to them that this wouldn't be good entertainment for the whole family, perhaps. But anyway, today's also the day of the first major battle of the Civil War. And in 1925, the monkey trial, the Scopes monkey trial, ended in Tennessee. And John Scopes, a high school teacher, was convicted of violating the state law for teaching the theory of evolution. That conviction was later overturned, but that was when we thought we put to bed the issue of whether science should rule in the classroom. And, of course, we are still back now dealing with evolution, although this time, since we are in the 21st century, evolution has the upper hand, science has the upper hand, and people trying to teach alternate theories that are non-science are trying to get through the courts, and so far, thankfully, they've been shut down. Let's move on to a couple of other things going on in the news. Anheuser-Busch has agreed to a $50 billion takeover. That was last week's news, really, but I didn't do a show last week because I was doing a recording session out in Kentucky with my colleague, John Clark. We recorded a series on technology. We may play some clips here on the air, but it wasn't really a radio series. It's a CD series that will be available on my website shortly. But what's interesting is the Belgian firm that bought them, InBev, isn't going to change much. But for a lot of Americans, they see this as a watershed event. When the king of beers, when Budweiser, gets bought by a non-American company, there must be trouble. In the same way, if you remember back in the 80s, when the Japanese had a lot of our cash and started buying up, things like Rockefeller Center they bought, and they bought a golf course. They bought Pebble Beach, maybe a few other high-profile properties. People said, the sky is falling. The Japanese will soon own most of America. Well, it didn't quite work out that way, did it? Now, this time, maybe a little more serious, not InBev buying Anheuser-Busch, but the fact that the dollar has fallen so much and China and other countries hold so much of our promissory notes because we have been deficit spending ever since George Bush got into office. He doesn't pay for his wars. He doesn't pay for his tax cuts. He doesn't pay for any of that stuff, you know? So you'd think the economy would be in better shape, since the whole purpose of $2 trillion in tax cuts is to alleviate problems, free that free market engine, and generate revenue for the Treasury with a successful economy with low taxes. Hasn't quite worked out that way, has it? That's what I love about the stimulus package that Congress has pushed through. We've talked about this before, but how is it that $2 trillion of tax cuts, which were backloaded, as we were told at the time, they weren't going to do much in 2001, 2, 3, and 4. It was backloaded to 2005 through 2010. Those tax cuts were going to really make sure that the economy would be fine. It's not so, is it? And of course, now, if the Democrats come to power, they are in power in the Congress, they're going to increase their lead. And if Obama is president, they will, of course, want to get our fiscal house in order, and they will want to restore a balanced budget. And so it's very likely that they will kill the Bush tax cuts, and the Republicans will scream, oh, these are tax increases. Hey, if the Democrats are the tax and spend party, then the Republicans are the borrow and spend party. I'd much rather do tax and spend. I refuse to stick my grandchildren with the cost of running the world while I'm around. We should be paying for it. Anyway, I'm not too worried about the Anheuser-Busch takeover. I think that it's no more significant than any particular takeover. The real issue is the trade deficit, the deficit spending, and our total debt, which is really high up there. Okay, so let's go to some lighter stuff for a minute. In the world of sports, golf was on the news this weekend. Of course, the Tour de France is taking place. The world is gearing up for the Olympics in Beijing, and had two sporting events, two things in golf worth mentioning. The first is that Michelle Wee, the teenager, who is really playing the best of her game, of her golf this year, she was in second place at the State Farm Classic. She forgot to sign her scorecard after the Saturday round and was disqualified. You must sign your scorecard before you leave the scoring area. So she's young. She'll make mistakes like that. Golf is one of those strange sports where you don't, not only don't you cheat, you report on yourself when you break the rules. Famous case a few years ago, Craig Stadler knelt down on a towel so that he could take a shot underneath the bush and get his ball out from underneath the bush. And when he realized that's an artificial way of enhancing your stance, he called the penalty on himself. It cost him two strokes, and I think he didn't make the cut of that tournament or something like that. And there's plenty of examples in golf like that. You know, in other sports, in baseball, a lot of pitchers or even batters pride themselves on their ability to cheat and hide it. That is, if you can put something on the ball as a pitcher, some gunk on the ball, and get away with it, then people don't really see that as a big problem. They're like, well, he's pretty cagey, isn't he? Just like the old spitballers. And the same with corked bats. Or in basketball, people will hold a guy's, in the NBA or college, people will hold somebody's shirt to try and keep them from jumping, or they'll pull on their shorts if they can get away with it to keep them from getting away. And the refs will sometimes see it, but they don't call that an intentional foul. It's clearly cheating, not just fouling someone. You're doing everything you can to prevent him from playing a normal game. So, well, I guess everything you can would be to trip him and break his leg. But you're doing what you can within limits. You're trying to get away with stuff. In golf, they don't try and get away with stuff. So Michelle Wee was disqualified. That's a big penalty to pay for just forgetting to sign your scorecard. Once you leave the area, you can't come back and say, oh, I should have signed this. No problem. We'll let you sign it. No. This is golf. This is a real sport. And this past weekend was the British Open. And I have to say, it was pretty entertaining. I was rooting for Greg Norman. Here he is, age 53. I have had acquaintances, I don't want to call them friends, people I've run into at work and that, who would say to me, rather ill-informed, oh, Greg Norman's a choker. Because Norman has lost two or three majors the hard way. He's near the lead going into the last few holes, and somebody comes up with a miracle shot. At least twice, people hold out on him from out in the fairway. And, in other words, got an eagle or a birdie when they might have been headed for par or worse. In other words, they made up a couple strokes on him quick right near the end of the tournament with miracle shots that only happen once in a lifetime to most of us. And he got robbed of a couple majors that way. So he's not a choker. The fact that he, as good a golfer as he was the number one golfer in the world for a long period of time. The fact that he's only won three majors and he's only won, I don't know how many tournaments he's won, but he's won a few. That just shows you how good Tiger Woods is. That, you know, for a successful career is three majors and, you know, double figures in tournament wins. Tiger has smashed those records and is approaching Jack Nicklaus's records. Anyway, I was rooting for Norman at the British Open. At age 53, he would have been the oldest man to win a tournament on the PGA Tour, a professional tournament, not simply a major or the British Open. It wasn't to be. Not only did Norman fade a little bit under brutal conditions, but Padraig Harrington repeated as champion. There was just no way to hold him down. He played the best golf of anybody on Sunday and walked away with the win. What's amazing was how bad the conditions were. The wind and the weather was wicked all weekend, and it took a tough course and made it almost impossible. Normally in something like the British Open or the U.S. Open, it's not like other golf tournaments in the course of the week, the course of the season. Sometimes 10 under par, 15 under par, 20 under par wins a PGA event. Because in America, the courses are relatively simple. That is, people play target golf. They got soft greens, and so you fly the ball in and try and stick it near the hole, and you make a lot of birdies. In the majors, in general, the U.S. Open, British Open, the rough is harder, the fairways are narrower, the pins are tucked in tougher positions, and the greens are cut shorter, so the greens are faster. So it's harder all the way around. And in the British Open in particular, it's a different style of golf. Links courses require you to approach it a little bit differently. Instead of flying the ball in and trying to land it on the green, most of the time in a British course, you have to run it up. So drop the ball in front of the green and run it on and try and get close to the hole. Very difficult to do that in the wind. Wind was carrying the ball 40, 50 feet one way or the other, depending when you got it up in the air. So they were trying to hit low shots in, which is an art form that most of us who play golf don't know how to do. And all in all, very tough to play. But Padraig Harrington ended up at 3 over par. Now, keep in mind, what I started to say when I said it was hard was that what they try and do is get it so that par is a good score, or one under wins the U.S. Open or the British Open. So that it's a true test of golf, and there's none of this 15 under. You want the course to stand up to the best players in the world. And not only did it stand up this time, beyond Padraig Harrington's 3 over par, there were three other scores under 10 under par. Otherwise, everyone in the field was 10 over par or higher. That is a tough course. Well, enough about golf. Let's move on. There is I think what we're going to do is go to a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about a few more things in the news before we get to the campaign.